Group meeting, Friday, 4th June, 1976.
Well, I don't know quite how I can express this, because I've not really thought out the question fully, but it is something which has always sort of been at the back of my mind since I've come to listen to you, and that is the question of inherent personality traits that people have, and how these are affected, if at all, in conduct, how would I say, in the world of reality, rather than when one is considering conduct which arises out of the attentive state, because one finds certainly at my own stage of development, or certain times I will stop myself. From not exactly stop myself, but pull myself up sharply and realize that I'm sort of lapsing into, say, bad old ways, if just for the sake of coining the phrase, if you like, and that if I can stop myself and then just be attentive, so that perhaps all the bad old ways do not exactly evaporate, but I can see them in some sort of perspective, you know, all the old complexes, and so you can see them, stand at a distance from them, if you like, and see them in perspective through the practice of attention. I don't know whether I'm expressing this properly, but overriding that, knowing several people, I don't know anything about it, who are interested in astrology, for instance, and they say, oh well, I'm a Leo, so you've got certain traits, as it were, which you can't help manifesting. How do these inherent personality traits, one presumably has to learn to live with them, accept them, and just watch them manifesting themselves through one, rather than fighting them according to a concept of how one should behave, and therefore setting up a friction? But it is that sort of a reconciliation which is maybe to call the war within one's own personality, and it's a reconciliation perhaps devoutly to be desired. And this is I've explained what I have to say probably very, very badly, but it may well be you understand the sort of thing I've got to say, and I would sort of welcome your views on this.
Well, this is a very interesting, in fact, not just one interesting point, but several very interesting points arise out of what you have said. First of all, we must realize that the religious life does not mean a specific aspect, a specific separate aspect of our lives from all other aspects. What is the great purpose, the aim of religiousness within us? It is that the individual, as an individual, constituted as he is, will come to full fruition as a human being. See? Now, as you said, the personality traits, they are inherent in us. Our blueprint is given to us from the time of our conception. You know the whole story, the genes and the whatnot. They all make up the particular pattern of the individual. He is like that. Now, this is the individual's capital, so to say. Now, he's got to utilize that capital intelligently, constructively. Now, how is he going to use it constructively and intelligently. The worldling will utilize his personality traits if he is aware of them and he has the skill to use them. He will utilize them for his personal gain, his personal benefit, the fulfillment of his desires and ambitions and so forth. In other words, he will use them to satisfy his self-orientation. Now this makes for the person who is not in complete harmony, in communion with his environment, with the totality, and so forth. Now the religious approach is the one which is concerned with the realization of one's own inner individuality in communion and in harmony with the totality, not self-oriented, but totality-oriented, which in a sense is an absurd phrase, because the very word orientation signifies something particular and limited. But you appreciate what I mean. So now, ourselves as we are, the environment in which we live is our school of life. Our business is to learn from the environment and learn through self-observation. Because all the time, what is oneself is interacting and is interdependent with the environment. We have to learn. And therefore, we shall learn only in our own unique way. And learning in our own unique way will imply, first and foremost, a clearer and clearer understanding of ourselves as we interplay with the environment. And here the whole question of attentiveness and mindfulness comes in. Now again, attentiveness and mindfulness can be of the worldling's type or that type which characterizes the religious. Remember that the religious is concerned with full fruition of himself too, just as the worldling is concerned with full satisfaction for himself. This is where the difference comes in. So that whilst the religious is mindful in the pure sense, the worldling is concerned with mindfulness in a different way. When one observes oneself as from the religious point of view, one comes to know oneself as he really is, and also what his actual potentialities are. And he utilizes them or allows them to find expression in terms of harmony with his environment. This will imply the functioning of the great spiritual values, as we call them. Love, wisdom, beauty, truth, goodness, and so on. it is wiser to put it in its negative form, because the spiritual values in their inner reality, in their transcendent reality, is something of which we have no conception. And if we form conceptions, because we are ourselves imperfect, our conceptions also will be imperfect. You see? Whereas the flaws in us are something with which we are at home all day and every day. And these are the things which raise up the problems and the conflicts and the disturbances and all the rest of it, the confusions and so forth. But this is what we can see here now. Now, in seeing this here now, we will naturally start off by saying, oh, I am furious, or I am putting a fast one over the other businessman, or something like that, you see. But instead of looking at it that way, one grows out of that and sees it as, this is harmful. This is unkind. This is jealousy. This is so and so. See? And in seeing it impersonally like that, one sees that all the world also suffers from the same things. If one sees how all the world suffers from the same things, instead of fighting against what we call a vice in the ordinary dualistic sense, instead of fighting against it, an extraordinary compassion arises within one. So, one doesn't fight oneself because of the evil one sees within oneself, nor does one fight against the other person, persons, who express the same evil. In this compassionate state, one is in right relationship with the environment and with other people. This is how we learn. And when we see this, not merely coldly, intellectually looking at it at a distance, but also we feel it so intensely and compassionately that we take it into our own psyche, then we are taking on the burden of the world's woe upon us. The principle of vicariousness functions throughout the universe. We cannot avoid it. If we try to avoid taking the world's woe upon our own shoulders, accepting that part of it which does inevitably fall upon our own shoulders, if we don't say no, if we do not refuse to accept it, you see, then the right thing happens. There is a transformation within ourselves. Otherwise, that transformation doesn't take place by mere cold intellectual perception at a distance. We are pushing the ill away from us. We have to take it into our own being. That doesn't mean that we are going to continue to be evil. Not at all. But by taking it into our own being and seeing this is evil and this is how mankind suffers, not only I, you see, then a transformation takes place. Now, the personality traits as such, whatsoever they are, what we commonly call good or bad, they all get changed. The good ones become purified just as much as the evil ones become purified. We think that because we are in the ordinary way, say, kind people, therefore all's well, we will not be cruel. Not at all. The person who is extremely kind, however great his kindness may be, if the provocation by the circumstance is powerful enough, will swing to the other end of the pendulum, you see, and be capable of extreme cruelty. This is one of the facts of our psychical life, because we function dualistically. I and you. I and the world. The self and the not-self. But the religious, seeing the thing as a whole, that this is something universal, frees himself from the duality. And then what we commonly call our virtues as well as our vices undergo the transformation. Personality traits are, they manifest themselves as our virtues and vices. The thing is not to fight against them, but to be well aware. Well aware, all the time. But aware in terms of a wholeness, not of thou and I, but thou I. This removes conflict. That is to say, it eliminates to a considerable, if not to a considerable extent, if not totally, the element of conflict within ourselves. If we are fighting ourselves, we are destroying ourselves. If we understand ourselves, we are healing ourselves. That is to say, we let ourselves become healed. The healing power is inherent in all people, in all things, in everything. And one has to let it function, the whole making power. We cannot say to ourselves, do this, do the other, psychologically, go through this discipline, go through that analysis, and lo and behold, we shall be well. We'll certainly obtain some sort of temporary result. And we'll find sooner or later that again something goes wrong. Because at right deep down is this consciousness of separateness, the irreligious consciousness, the sinful state. This is the primordial sin, thou and I, two separate creatures. This is the fundamental meaning of the word sin. Whatsoever sunders the unity of the universe is sin. And that state of being sundered is the sinful state. So that it's not merely moralistic. It is total for the individual as well as for the environment. So perhaps if one works upon this and penetrates into it, then inner calm, inner strength functions unhindered. The healing process can take place. Now the lessons we learn must necessarily be learned through the medium of our actual qualities and abilities. None of us have every ability or every quality as such. There is a certain pattern of the individual. Let that pattern be perfectly beautiful. That's our business. And in that, one flowers into a true human being. And everyone will be different and unique. And that's the charm and the marvel of it. Otherwise, what a dull world it would be. Remember Hitler? A million hands go up like that. What is that? Even nuts and bolts have a little more individuality than that.
So really for us, one flowers under the individual pattern of the individual.
See, this is why ideas like following in the steps of the master ideas like that are so inadequate and misleading. What do we mean by following the footsteps of the master or carrying out the instructions of the teacher? Let us assume that the teacher is a perfected holy one. The master is one of the perfected ones. All right. But when I say I am going to follow in the footsteps of the master, what I'm actually doing is trying to follow in the footsteps of my own conceptions of the master and my own interpretations of what he teaches. No one can escape that. None of us can escape that. As I say these words, naturally your brain has to make its own interpretation of what I'm saying. But will the content of your interpretation exactly coincide with the content of my interpretation and my meaning? It won't. It of necessity it will be different, because every one of us is different. You see? So when I say I'm following the master's teaching, what I'm doing is I'm following my own mental constructs and not examining these mental constructs of mine. This is the thing, this is the real attentiveness, mindfulness, and self-awareness. It is not any sort of morbid or mechanical introspection as most people know it and carry out, you see. It is a tremendously wide awake activity to be able to see within oneself. And therefore, obviously, the way lies within oneself. And you might say, but then it's hopeless. Why should I read any books? Why should I listen to anybody? Why should I try to learn from nature? It's all outside me, I say. You see, I started off by saying outside me. You see how naturally we say outside me, but it isn't outside. When we meet, when we talk, if we meet with the urge, the natural impulsion to meet together, it is this togetherness which enriches our own inward process. If we meet, if we come together in the wrong spirit, if we come together out of love with each other, and I mean love in the profoundest sense here, not in the sense of having adoration or appreciation of this person, or oh, he's marvelous, or she's wonderful the way she talks, and you just sit like this and listen. You are just wallowing in your own emotional state, that is all. But this real thing, the total acceptance of the other person and the total giving of oneself to the other person, and in that there is no hindrance, there is no sinful state, no separation. Now, when meeting like that takes place, then whatever words and thoughts are expressed a conversation takes place. You see? Then there is development, there is value in that. Because under those circumstances, one can truly consider what has been said. You don't swallow it lock, stock and barrel blindly, because you are only swallowing your own mental constructs. Your one's own mind, one's own processes, one is aware of, one's own interpretation, but the mind is quiet and trying to absorb in fullness what the other is trying to put across, you see. And in that state, there is a psychical interaction which is extremely fruitful, really fruitful. And it comes out usually not immediately. Sometimes it comes out immediately. You get the real flash of insight. You're suddenly seeing revelation, so to say, you see. But usually it comes out as time passes by, because this inner process goes on in your own brain, unbeknown to you. And that way one grows. Then you are not following in the footsteps of the master or anything, but you are realizing that the way of fulfillment lies within yourself. That is the most important point. And the self, because one is awake to the fact that one is not separate from the rest, the self is in harmony with the rest. And therefore the way becomes the total way, so to say, the whole way, which includes the entire environment. Now this is the way of the religious. You look at the worldling, two intelligent people discussing something. One says, yes, that's excellent, that's very good, I do appreciate that. But that's not my way. Now, if you sort of feel, if you just sit quiet, you the third party, listening to something like that going on, you feel out the psyche of each person, you'll see that these two are just superficially in relationship with each other. They are not really communicating fully or communing fully. And that's a waste of time and energy. It's just the usual chatter, chatter, chatter of the world. The way lies within. But that which is without can stimulate the way within, if one is open and considers together with the other person. This way real teaching takes place. And it is not a case of, here is the teacher, and exclusively the teacher, and there is the disciple, exclusively the disciple. They are both interacting, they are both learning from each other all the time. The one who is, we say so-and-so is the perfected Holy One, and we are inclined to think, he's come to the end of the road, he is fit now, there's this wonderful statue of perfection. Just the case. The Holy One is constantly learning, constantly growing, constantly progressing. Just like the Unholy One is, if he gets to. We have a wonderful analogy in life. Consider the geniuses of the world. Did Bach stop learning at a certain stage? Now I'm the perfect writer of fugues and so on, and there's nothing more to achieve or realize? Not at all. He writes more and more wonderful things. And as long as the brain doesn't deteriorate, or the living organism doesn't deteriorate in some way which hinders the process, The creative genius just goes on and on and on and on. There is no end to it. It's the same with the religious life. God, as postulated by mankind, represents something which itself is in continuous change and growth and development. If you like to just, for the time being, just take the God concept as representing an extraordinary being, that being is growing, evolving, developing, learning all the time. Well, even you and I can see that there are some things in the universe which are a little bit troublesome occasionally. And they say it's God's universe, all right? He's produced one or two troublesome things. And he scratches his head just as much as you and I scratch ours over problems. See, basically we just have such a poor conception of what it means to live the religious life. We think of it fragmentarily. We think of it as we think of our professional work. You see, I'm a motor mechanic, and I go to the garage or the factory or whatever it is and perform the same action over and over again every day. That is my job. And our minds are so conditioned that we think of everything in that manner. But that is not the way of life. Life is a perpetual miracle, constantly new, ever fresh, always teaching us something. Through our depressions, through our annoyances, through our flaring up, through our states of exaltation, of sublimity, of intense peace and happiness, through everything we are learning, we can learn, I mean.
You say that it teaches the worldling. Life teaches the worldling, but and it also teaches the holy one or the religious person. But does the worldling in fact learn anything? The reason I ask that, of course, is because he is caught up in duality, and this is the samsara or whatever, the wheel, they're being caught up in this. How can he learn, being subject of his conditioning and reconditioning?
Let us look at it this way, and I think we'll get a slightly better picture of the situation. The worldling learns much more slowly than the one who has a sense of relationship, of communion with his environment and with his fellow beings. He's a slow learner, whereas the other learns more quickly. But everybody in some way or other learns. And if he learns in the wrong way, positively wrong way, he deteriorates, becomes an evildoer, becomes insane, does greater harm to himself and to others.
That presumably is not wisdom, but that is unwisdom, if you like. So he is in fact not ascending the scale of wisdom, but descending. So that is not a process in fact, perhaps, of learning in the sense you were using it, but is a sense of increased ignorance.
Yes, that is true. That is true. We must remember this. In the universal process, there are many, many failures. So much wastage takes place. This is part of the universal process. See, this is why death is a blessing. If not for death, think of the accumulation of evil that would go on.
Doesn't bear thinking.
You see? This mysterious manifestation of primordial energy, creative energy, which we call life, has its own way. This energy brings into being, and what is not useful or has outworn its usefulness or is positively against the stream, the life force destroys it, and destroys it very ruthlessly too. Take a somewhat, it's a little bit crude, the analogy, but it may be helpful. Consider the beginnings of the human race. 3-4 million years ago, or whatever the time was. How did we learn in those days? We learned through the activity of natural phenomena. That was part of our natural phenomena were part teacher of mankind. Earthquakes, volcanoes, disasters, terrible things happening. And the awful cruelty of man upon man, not that that has ceased in our own day and age, but all these things were there. And all those forces and events which taught us were very harsh, very cruel. There were also kind things happening. But life in its totality held all the opposites in it. And life itself, in some mysterious way, has this teleological activity. It is a purposeful movement within the limits of every particular context. Whether that context is the plant world, or the animal world, or the human world, there is a teleology observable. That is why we, human beings today, have evolved, as we say. We are so different from what our primordial ancestors were like. So different. You see, and there is a development. There is no doubt about that. We today have much greater sensitivity, refinement, the power to penetrate into the inner nature of things, the capacity for insight has grown, and with it the expression of that insight, first in intellectual terms and then in terms of techniques and ways of life and so on and so on, which the old people didn't have. This is the progress, as we might call it, through time And it can take place only through time. It is inherent in terms of eternity. But what is inherent in terms of eternity knows neither pleasure nor pain, joy nor sorrow, fulfillment or failure. It is this mysterious force in the Kabbalistic and Judaic teaching. It is represented by Yahweh. Yahweh is the immanence within us. What we call, what some religions have called God immanent in oneself, the divine spark in one, what Hinduism called the Atma, what Buddhism called the essence of mind, you see, and so forth. It is immanent in us, us as human beings. That aspect of creative activity and energy which produced the universe was named Elohim. In theistic terminology, God the Creator, He who made all things. But this Yahweh immanence, the immanent God within us, is the one that exerts a curious influence that ultimately redeems us. It is not the maker of things, it's not the almighty maker of things, the controller of things as such, but that which endures, suffers, is infinitely patient, learns, and at last enables the release into complete fulfillment to take place, redeems us from suffering, evil, and all the rest of it. So we get Elohim on the one hand and Yahweh. They are both names for the same thing. These are all ways of talking, remember. You see? Now, trouble is that when we talk, we get the thought patterns and we think, now that's the truth, I've got the truth. I haven't got the truth. I've got a photograph of it. But the photograph is never the living substance. You can't marry a photograph. You can't do business with a photograph. You can't have yoga lessons from a photograph. You get it from a living person. It's a living interaction. This is what slips our awareness. But when we become truly attentive in the supreme sense, then we are perpetually alive for the first time, in the full sense of the word, within our own self. Otherwise, we are alive merely because Elohim continues this, keeps this factory working. But when Yahweh comes to full fruition within ourselves, then Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God, and that is you. This is the purpose of our existence. One way of expressing our purpose. There are so many marvelous ways of expressing the purpose of our existence. Another way, which is completely tied up with this, is that when we see this sort of thing very, very clearly, and we live from within ourselves in the way which spells the true release of the perfect human within us, then each one of us becomes the instrument through which these transcendent energies flow in and out all the time. man is intended to be the living vehicle of transcendence. When mankind represents in itself what today we call perfection, the divine being, what we call the divine being, then by that time mankind will have changed structurally too into something more wonderful. Evolution, no one can, I can't foresee what that sort of creature would be. But who would have thought that our common ancestor, the ancestor of the hominids and the anthropoids, would produce one strain, the anthropoids, and the other strain became the hominids and became men. And look at the difference between them. Who could have foreseen that? That primordial ancestor? No. But if you and I allow the mind to be quiet and sense this extraordinary activity of transcendence without laying down fixed forms to say that, the God functions this way, or transcendence or creative energy functions thus and thus and thus. No, not that way. You just sense it and feel it. It seems as if such and such is the trend. And then your inner sensitivities are functioning and purifying the conscious intellectual perceptions of these things. And then there is real growth. We live by virtue of life, the mystery, not life as we think it is. You see, when one begins to see things like this, the conflict of the opposites disappears. Conceit and false humility, the two opposites, they just disappear, don't they? Can you really see this? You are just quiet. There is neither conceit nor a cringing humbleness within one. You see? And in what has happened is that one has transcended the duals. One hasn't got rid of either dual. This is the point to bear in mind. But you have transformed this dualistic manifestation of your life energy through your psychical and mental and physical activities and integrated them into a third marvelous thing. The real fulfillment. It is like a thesis and antithesis interacting with each other in such a manner that neither is destroyed, but both integrate and a new something comes into being. Unpredictable, unforeseen. And that's where the real wonder and delight and joy of existence and life comes in. You've made life beautiful. And yourself too.
The naming process stops, doesn't it?
Yeah. That is to say, the fixating aspect of the naming process. One cannot possibly live consciously in any environment without knowing names. You have to name all the time. You have to recognize. If you do not recognize, you will be wiped out.
No, I didn't make myself clear. I meant when I said the naming process, whereas I really meant as far as the emotions are concerned.
Mm-mm-mm.
One sees the emptiness of qualities that we call hate and dislike and unbelief, which has been, these things have been rather bedeviled, haven't they, by so many isms stressing the positive side of life. This energy, as I understand it, as you have spoken this evening, is completely neutral, isn't it? This energy flows. So it's neither yours nor mine. It is just energy.
Look, the transcendent. And the, because we live in this scientific age, which has investigated and gone as far as it has, the word energy is synonymous with transcendence or God or ultimate reality or anything, you see. This energy is characterless. This is very difficult to, for the intellect to grasp. You see, look at the way in which Hinduism, Brahmanical teaching and Upanishadic teaching presented it. The individual realizes his own Atma. Now the flaw in that statement is in saying his own Atma. That possessive pronoun is the flaw, fly in the ointment. It should simply be put, he realizes the Atma. And even that is a slightly misleading form in which to put it. What he does is that he allows the transcendent to function freely through him. It is then that I am the I-ness, the separative I-ness in me is absent. Altogether absent. And when that is absent, the transcendent is present, unhindered. The transcendent is always there, but I cover him over with a black cloth and put him into a black box and keep him shut up in a dark room. When that I-ness is gone out, the light is there, free. So now, that Atma has been spoken of as neti, neti, not this, not this, not anything you can conceive of or talk of. You can't measure it, you can't weigh it, you can't smell it, taste it, touch it, anything. That is the Atma. What did the Buddha say? He used a whole phrase where the Upanishads used a single word, vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbatopabhavam. Vijnanam means discriminative consciousness. Now, discriminative consciousness is a specialized manifestation of the living process of a living creature. Living creatures have discriminative consciousness. Animals have discriminative consciousness. And they use their senses as their instruments through which to discriminate between what is dangerous or destructive to them and what is helpful to them to continue their life and so forth. But in the Pali, the phrase is vijnanam, this discriminative consciousness, anidassanam, without any characteristics. Now it has ceased to be discriminative consciousness, in fact. Anidassanam, anantam, endless, therefore beginningless, therefore not of time, but of eternity. Immeasurable, imponderable, unknowable by the brain, by thought and feeling and word. All these things are implied in that. One has to get the sense of it. I can't possibly explain what that is. But if and when you really care, you allow that thing to enter, light up within you. And then in this peculiar way, you know it through your unknowing in conceptual terms.
Unknowing.
You see? This is one of the deep meanings of the cloud of unknowing. It comes not only in Christian mysticism. You find the phrase dharma megha, the dharma cloud, the cloud of unknowing, that is what it really is. You find it in Indian terminology too. Anantam, so vijnanam, anidarsanam, anantam, sabbato, everywhere, pabham, shine. Another word which is sometimes used instead of pabham is pahang, accessible. Well, these are things quite beyond human conceiving. This, something like this, gives one the feel of this transcendence, this transcendent creative energy, given all these different names. And when that wakes up within oneself, and one begins to sort of let it function, live by it, then there is the real fulfilling of the individual being. Now don't run away with the idea that this fulfilling will mean, we'll have a wonderful time. There'll be no such thing as a wonderful time. The wonderfulness will consist in its timelessness, and therefore in its transcendental sorrowlessness. But in terms of our everyday, day-to-day manifested life and experience, there will be pleasure, pain, sorrow, joy, etc., that you can't avoid. That is impossible to avoid, that must not be avoided, otherwise you cut yourself off from the rest of the world. You have to let it come into you. And because this light now is shining within, that inward poise is never upset. It is there. If and when your parent, your child, your beloved, your friend dies, and you are living the holy life, striving to live it, have you ceased to feel sorrow? If you have, you are not a holy one. You will feel the sorrow of the event as such. But if the light is strong enough within, that poise will remain. And you will simultaneously be aware of the transcendent aspect of this terrible event, this sorrowful event. The transcendent aspect is like this. What does death do? It releases the finite, constricted expression of life into the total infinite, into the absolute freedom. You can know this as a thought. I have said these words, supposing you just accept the words and the thought. You can know it as a thought, but the thought by itself is impotent. It can help to look in the right direction, in the right way, but the thought by itself is impotent. If your inner consciousness is really awake to the fact that this, what we call the life-death process, the life-death alternation, is really a life, other life pulsation, then you will know the totality of the sorrow, the heartbreak felt in death, as well as the supreme ecstasy, the supreme, yes, supreme ecstasy of death. From constricted, restricted being, you are released into total being. The utterly free, utterly unconstricted being. And any thing that comes into being means that it has died out of the totality into the particular expression. When transcendence functions in terms of death, the other life, the individual restricted thing is released into the supreme all thing. When the supreme all thing wants to have a little fun and enjoy itself, it can only do so by restricting itself into the particular and obtaining particular experiences. So my being born here means I have died out of transcendence into this. And when this is dead, it has moved into the other life of infinite freedom and transcendence. Don't regard this as a philosophy. Philosophy, science, and all those things belong to the realm of the limited.